Hi there, I'm Ben Morton and welcome to my podcast. The aim of the show is to really dig into the art and science of leadership through interviews with MDs, CEOs and other senior leaders. In doing so, I'm going to try and decode and identify all of the things that we can be doing to become even better leaders for our organisations and for those that we have the privilege and responsibility to lead. In this episode, episode number 2, I'm joined by Phil Jones, who is the Managing Director of the UK arm of the multinational information, communication and technology manufacturer Brother. I first met Phil around 6 years ago and I was immediately struck by his passion for leadership and I guess really building a great culture that makes others feel safe whilst enabling them to perform at their best or perform at the very highest level. And then when I started thinking about launching this podcast, I knew that I had to have Phil on the show and I'm delighted to have him as my very first guest. In this episode, which was recorded really early on in the COVID-19 lockdown here in the UK, we covered a lot of ground, including things like leading in a crisis or really challenging times, the importance of being clear on your personal vision, mission, values and guiding principles. And we also looked at life goals, Phil's horizon scanning technique and being able to drop the mask as leaders so that those that we lead can really get to know the real us. So without any further delay or preamble from me, here's my conversation with Phil Jones. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Ben, thanks very much indeed for having me. I'm really humbled that you've asked me to be involved today.
So the kind of first thing I want to ask really for those listening is just tell me a little bit about sort of your current role, Phil, and your route into that job. What's your backstory, as it were?
Okay, so my current role is I'm the managing director of the UK subsidiary of the global multinational called Brother. And so our job in the UK is to effectively take to market the range of technology products that Brother make. And so I've been with the company now for, my goodness, 26 years, believe it or not. I'd never intended to stay that long, by the way, but I joined in 1994 as a fax salesman. Did a few years in that job and then quite unexpectedly got the opportunity to interview for, at the time, the sales director of the company. And that was in 2001. I got that job, which was amazing, which basically put me into sort of a non-executive position at that particular time. That is a non-board position. I did that job for 2 years, then I took on marketing as well. So in 2003, became the sales and marketing director for Brother UK. I did 9 years in that job, and I was actually appointed to the executive board at that same time, which was an interesting lesson for me on board dynamics and your role as a board director. I got appointed deputy MD in 2012, and I did a year in that role, and then ultimately was appointed to be managing director in 2013. So that was an amazing day for me, because you join a company in 1994 as a salesman, and there you go. You know, nearly 20 years later, you're actually walking through the door as its managing director. So, that's the sort of the potted history of the last 25 years.
Wow, that's incredible. And it's rare that you speak to somebody who's kind of gone through kind of such a journey with one company. So I guess the question that occurs to me from that is, of all of those kind of leadership and management transitions you've experienced in your time at Brother UK, sort of which was the most challenging for you, and why, and how did you deal with some of those challenges?
That was pretty easy. I think it was actually in 2001 when I was appointed to be the sales director, because at that particular time, I'd been in the company for around about 7 years. Most of my experience was just really managing a product category. I just had a few people to individually manage. So that was more of a one-to-one relationship between sort of manager and people. But this was the time when I kind of had to really transition into the sort of in inverted commas, leadership role. And I really was, frankly, out of my depth. I think I was technically very competent at what I did. But actually, probably from a leadership point of view, there was an enormous vacuum, in my opinion, about kind of leadership and my skills. And suddenly I became a manager of managers. And I'd kind of, this was very unfamiliar territory to me. At that time, I had this serendipitous telephone conversation. It really was just, I thank whoever organized that up somewhere upstairs, this phone call, which was, at the time we dealt with a company called QVC, and we had a Today Special Value on, which was one of our first ever multifunction printers. And at the time it was de rigueur to hire a presenter. So we hired a presenter for the day who would sort of, you know, lavishly point at all these wonderful features of the printer. And what you would do is you would call in two or three times a day to the studio and speak to the presenter to see how sales were going, give them feedback, you know, point more at this, talk more about that, etc. And at the end of the day, she said to me, "Oh, you wouldn't have a quick word with my husband, would you?" I said, "All right, what about?" She said, "Well, he's a sort of a sports psychologist, and he's really trying to get into business. And he thinks his model in sports psychology is very transferable to create high performing teams in a business." And of course, here was I in this new role, feeling really out of control, unskilled, you know, unprepared. And I just thought, well, what have I got to lose? So I invited him to come and talk to me. And therein started a journey, I guess, on my own development as a human being and as a leader. And when we first met, I kind of said to, his name is Stephen Sylvester. He's a very famous psychologist with a fabulous book, Detox Your Ego. I'd recommend anybody to read. Right. I said to Steve, "Right, Steve, what I want is, you know, I want this team to be really good." And he said, "Brilliant. We can take these teams and make them really good. But to do that, we've got to make you really good, Phil. So actually, before we do any work with anybody else, you and me will do 3 months of work together, one-to-one. And what we'll do, we'll sort of turn you inside out and just see where that takes us in order that we can get you in the right position to lead this team." So I agreed to that. And that was probably a complete turning point for me in my life and in the journey of transitioning from manager to leader. It was very difficult because it meant I had to face some very difficult questions about who I was and what people thought about me. And some of those calibration discussions were some of the most difficult I've ever had in my life, because you wander around any organization thinking that you're brilliant and doing a good job because you're delivering the numbers. But then when you ask somebody to genuinely give their opinion about you, and what you hear is not the perception of what you think you want to hear, that was really tough. Probably the one of the biggest transitions that I had to go through. And I think it's been one of the most rewarding, and one that I think set me up for my entire leadership career.
So I'm intrigued to sort of get a sense of what that looked like. So without asking you to bare your soul to the hundreds of listeners, but like what did that look like, and what were some of the sort of developmental areas you focused on as a leader?
Yeah, I guess one thing I think we sometimes, because we're British and we don't often talk about feelings and emotions much, I didn't quite realize I had this enormous emotional rucksack which I carried with me most of the time, which would then begin to inform even decision-making and how I operated around people. So what I quickly established was that I built this technical competence on just delivery. And what I was often using in that process to deliver is I was seeing people as just simply resources to help me deliver the things I wanted to deliver, and almost overlooking the human element of, you know, well, what motivates them and why would they help me? And actually, I probably was very transactional as an individual. It was all about delivering the result regardless of what's going on in your life. And you know, I spent years in sales then, so this was kind of just, it was always about the goal, delivery of the goal, delivery of the number. And I think that when I went out and began to really, you know, stare directly at the problems and say, well, actually, why do I operate like this? Why do I have a work mask? why am I different at home when I'm with my family as to when I am in the workplace? And what you begin to realize is actually much of this is about your self-image and self-opinion of yourself. And when you can deal with that and understand why you operate, you can begin to repair, renew, give up behaviors that no longer serve you and start to operate at a higher level, in my opinion. But that process was also meant having some really tough conversations, as I hinted a moment ago, where you'd sit with you down and just sort of say, look, this might seem really weird, but I've been asked by Stephen to ask you what your real opinion is of me. And would you just help me by telling me what you generally think about the way that I work with you? And you just hear this honesty come back from people and say, Phil, we all think you're a lovely bloke, but sometimes you're just a bit too direct with us, or you're not sensitive to what I've got on going on right now. It's always about your priorities. And you think, oh God, well, I didn't mean that. That wasn't my intent, but actually this is how it was coming across. So it gave a lot of feedback very quickly, Ben, about the things that I needed to change about myself in the way that I operated within the business.
That's great. And like the question that's buzzing around my head as you were talking, Phil, was like, what gave you the confidence or drive or maybe courage to sit and have those conversations with those individuals where you're asking sort of very openly, I guess, sort of really dropping your mask, laying yourself bare and saying, look guys, like give me some feedback? Because I know sort of many leaders who I work with, something seems to get in their way and they don't quite manage to have those conversations. What was it for you that enabled you to do so?
It was very difficult. And I think it always, as human beings, is very difficult to go and ask for somebody to give feedback on you and what you might perceive as your flaws when they may not even be evident to you. That naturally is an uncomfortable space to be in. But I think at the time, like anything, there was accountability there because I had sort of I had a meeting with Stephen, weekly. And
okay,
I knew I had this meeting in the future where I'd need to be accountable to Stephen, where he would say, okay, by next week, I'm expecting this. And in this process, I wanted to fully commit to it. So I fully committed to it, which meant these conversations had to take place. I had to bring the data back. I couldn't have any excuses in reality about non-action. So that initially, I think, was the driver, and I think is often a lesson in life, is actually when you're a CEO, is who actually are you accountable to? And I think that's a question when you ask people that actually when you are in charge of a company, most people are accountable to you. So actually, who are you accountable to when it comes to this, how am I improving? How am I becoming a better version of myself? Which is where I think maybe people should have executive coaches or help or mentors or support groups or just a great bunch of mates that you can talk to, where these conversations can be had in a sort of fairly safe way. And, at the time, remember, Stephen's competency was an organizational psychologist. Mm-hmm. It's in a pretty safe place that I could have any conversation that I wanted to. And, in being honest with you and your listeners, there were times where we'd be in a pub in Newton Le Willows in Cheshire on a Monday night. And by week three, we'd walk in and the landlord would sort of nod at me and say, there's a quiet space over in the corner, because he knew that he'd observed that many of these sessions I'd be crying and the emotion that some of this feedback was hitting me was coming out. And so that's what I mean when you really are going through this inside out journey. It takes a lot of personal courage to deal with your flaws and how you improve, in my opinion. So having accountability and somebody that can walk with you on that journey, I think was part of the winning pattern of getting me to where I got to.
Yeah, I'm fascinated, and if I'm not careful, we could spend the rest of the time we've got today just talking about sort of that emotional aspect of leadership. And you mentioned a few minutes ago some sort of wearing a work mask. It's fascinating because that's been part of my journey as a leader and coach over the last few years, in that one of my strengths has always been sort of emotional control. And I'd always very much seen it as a strength, even from a young boy. People always, teachers said, Ben is very calm and steady. He would be a good leader. He's calm in a crisis. And for me, that had always been, I'd always viewed that as a sense of leadership strength. And then as I started to do some of the work that you've been talking about, this strength in emotional, the strength around controlling my emotions really, really showed up, emotional control. And my coach, who's also a friend, said to me, said, well, Ben, as well as I know you, sometimes I don't have a clue what's going on. And if you really want to connect with people, she said, how about dropping your mask a little bit and letting people see the real you? And then kind of that journey continued for me, where I was at a conference with about 300 people, and I found myself standing up talking to people about emotional control. And the guy who was speaking said something along the lines of, like, what's holding you back? Why don't you release and show your emotions a bit more? And I said, because emotional control is what's always made me successful. It's what made me successful as an army and the leader. And he kind of paused, looked me dead in the eye, and said, but what if it hasn't? What if you could have been an even better leader if you'd let people in? And I suspect you've probably had these moments. It just completely floored me. It was a complete paradigm shift that I'd never considered before. So this is probably a poor question I'm going to ask, but just tell me a little bit more. I'm intrigued to know a little bit more about that kind of letting the emotions out, letting people see the real you, and sort of what impact you've seen that have for you as a leader and those who work for and around you.
Yeah, I think for me, it's been transformational, Ben, in my own organization. And I guess in not only that, in my own happiness,
right.
That actually having to, you know, emotionally regulate all the time can become quite tiring, and more tiring than you realize. That you're sort of suppressing who you really are, I guess. Where actually, you know, a word I use a lot at our place, which people are very familiar with now, is alacrity. And alacrity simply just means a happy state of readiness.
Okay.
The important word there, happy, and then state of readiness. So what we want people, I guess, is people always poised to be in a position to change something, to change the business model, to change what they do, so for the organization to be able to evolve very, very quickly, you know, under changing circumstances. And that is paying us enormous dividends right now as we deal with the COVID-19 crisis. But if you start with happiness and you really put happiness at the front of your life, then actually what I believe is you literally come to this amazing state of flow. Where actually, providing you've got the sort of the technical ability to run a business, and that in itself is a skill. You know, don't get me wrong. You can't just rock up because you're emotionally intelligent and run a business. Running a business is really technically complex, and you have to have the skills to do that. And so I've got a career of building those skills. But actually what you then need to add in is the sort of that secret source of then having that emotional intelligence in order that you can then glue those together to create the right outcomes for your organization. So, you know, that journey of how do I come from here to there is particularly tough. But when I look back at in our internal, in our company, and we can look at evidence like investors in people. You know, we're investors in people, platinum employer. We're one of the first to get it in the country. We've just again, we won the award for investors in people, platinum employer of the year. So the most platinum of all platinums, if you see what I mean, which I find a bit hilarious. But if you look at the leadership ratings we have in our company, they're off the scale for my personal leadership style in terms of people's confidence in it. And I think, well, why is that? Well, actually, because I try and keep it very human. Mm. And now because I found out who I am and I'm happy with the result, most importantly, because sometimes people find it and they're not happy with the result. So I'm happy with who I now am, and I'm really comfortable with who I am as a person. And then I can combine that with the leadership skills and competencies needed to then run the business. And I found that when you can get to that moment, your business can find a state of flow, your leadership style can find a state of flow, and your culturally naturally begins to find its state of flow behind you.
Yeah, amazing. It kind of leads us in nicely. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about that we spoke about briefly before we hit record this morning, you mentioned values, especially right now as we're kind of recording this, as the UK is sort of 1 week into lockdown. Where do values fit into leadership for you, and how important are they?
Well, I think values are... developing your own set of values as an individual was probably one of the most powerful things you can do. And quite often when I'm asked to sit with people who might say, you know, I'm leading a business now, and you know, I've been newly promoted into the role, and you know, what's your advice and all those sorts of things, you know, the first thing that I'll do is ask somebody, you know, what is your ding? And I make sure I clarify that what I mean by that. So ding is kind of like a, you know, what is it that when you ring that bell, and you know, remember those hotel bells that you had, you know, that you, yeah, you ask for attention and you bang it and you go ding. And I go, well, look, if that sound, that ding, is you as a person at your absolute best, you know, where you're most comfortable, most happy, then what is it? What are the characteristics of that sound that we can nail down? And what we do is I just take people into a quick framework, which I call VMVP, vision, mission, values, and principles. So, and this is no different than strategic planning work we do in any organization. It's just applying it to yourself.
Right.
You know, what is it that you want for your life? What do you think your overarching bigger purpose would be? You know, the mission, what are the daily activities and things that you should be doing to try and achieve that? Your values, what are the hard and fast rules, the black and white areas of the way you decide things that you're not prepared to compromise on? And the principles, which are more broad things, which would, if you were looking at, you're thinking about it as a set of traffic lights, you know, values really are the red and the green. Principles are the amber.
Got you.
So they create a sort of the broad operating things of, I'm thinking more like that than this, but I'm prepared to be convinced. Values are hard and fast.
Yeah.
So once you have that very, very clear, you get this clarity around who you are, why you're here, how you decide things, what is important to you, more importantly, and how every decision you make can be guided to some degree by your personal principles and values, but not only that, but also the companies. And therefore, there normally needs to be a fairly strong alignment between who you are as a person and what you stand for, your VMVP, and the company that you're running and the culture that you're in.
Yeah, totally.
So once you get that right, once you've got clarity about who you are, in my experience, life becomes pretty easy because you can put everything through that decision-making filter of, you know, well, I'm presented with this problem, what should I do? And so, for example, you know, we are in a real, you know, very fast-moving situation with the COVID-19 coronavirus situation. And of course, one of the acronyms that I use, Ben, is that you said earlier about keeping calm in a crisis. So I want to just break down calm for you in terms of how that applies to my own leadership style. So calm is, I'd like to just say, is C stands for compassion.
Right.
A stands for action orientation. L stands for level-headedness. and M stands for mindfulness.
Nice.
So let's just break that through in terms of what do we mean. Compassionate means, right, think of others, be selfless, not selfish. You know, who is it in our supply chain? What can we do? We can pay people on time. We can reach out to our freelancers. We can ensure our own people are really well looked after and feeling cared for as a business. Action orientated, you know, now's the time where we've got to start making very rapid and quick decisions. And, you know, you probably heard that saying before of, you know, go slow when you can, go fast when you must.
Yeah.
This is a time to go fast. And I realized that I now need to be, you know, moving from leading from the back to leading from the front. So I've had to change very, very quickly from my natural style, which is to lead from the back, push others out for the applause, to suddenly, look, I've got to jump on the bridge very, very quickly now, be seen, be visible, start taking decisions for people very, very quickly in this rapid environment that we're in. Level-headedness, you know, don't be over-emotional. You know, be rational, get as much evidence as you can, do the right thing. And then M, mindfulness. So be mindful of every decision that you take, that it will have a consequence, not just in the day, but in the future. And we've seen huge number of examples already in the media of CEOs that are shooting from the hip, doing what serves their organization best, being very selfish about the way that they want this outcome to be. And that selfishness rather than selflessness towards others will be remembered for a very long time. So for me, staying calm is what this is all about, using that acronym, because that sits very well with the values of who I am as a person, about truthfulness and honesty.
It
allows me to act with compassion towards other people, to not just be thinking about, you know, what we've got at Brother, but actually our wider community of people that depend on us. And this has very much driven then the outcomes that we need as a business, which we've just identified in this crisis. Three major outcomes, which is to look after our own people in order that they can keep the business moving. To be thinking about keeping our supply chain moving so that it can make sure that the people that are depending on using our products right now, and bear in mind, we have got 80,000 GP surgeries that use our computer printers that you every day. So keeping our supply chain moving is about service to those people, because, you know, right now people may not perceive Brother plays any part in this crisis, but actually, do you know what? There are millions of people that need their prescriptions. Even if it's not related to Corona, they've still got critical illnesses that need care. So we've got to remember that we're part of that supply chain, and we've got to keep going for those people. So that's more about selflessness, but that's built into our supply chain. And finally, our third thing is about supporting those that are supporting others. So really making sure that actually we are speaking to our freelancers, speaking to our local communities, and anybody that fundamentally has a specific role supporting other people right now, and making sure that we're there for them.
Yeah, that's amazing. There's so many questions I could ask you based on what you've just said. Like, I just want to, if you don't mind, stick with the values piece for a while. So
yeah.
So I'm a huge, huge believer that kind of some of the most transformational work we can do as leaders is I call it sort of the deep inner work we do on ourselves, as you just described. But I think one of the things that people can sometimes struggle with is making the practical link after they've identified their values. For some who are kind of maybe at the start of this journey, they can sort of spend some time looking at their values and think, okay, great, I get that on a theoretical level. I understand why values are important. What did it look like for you, and how did you get to the point where, what did you practically do once you'd identified those values to really help them drive your actions and decision making? And what stopped it just being a list of values, words you had written in a nice journal or notepad somewhere, but maybe never saw the light of day? Like, how did it become tangible for you?
Yeah, I think that really is one of the hardest things that people struggle with, is, you know, they'll sit in a classroom for a day, you know, get some great outputs, wander out with them and not put anything into action fundamentally. And, you know, what I really wanted to say was, but actually, well, look, if this is about, you know, being congruent as an individual, and, you know, if my personal congruency, which is, you know, my alignment against, you know, my personal happiness and who I am, then you've got no choice but to live these things, because they can effectively determine almost everything that you want to do in your life. So a practical example might be now, Ben, is that lots of people demand my time and ask for my time. And whether that might be at a speaking event, oh, please come and talk to this event or that event or this other event. And, you know, part of my kind of VMVP is actually, you know, to try and inspire and encourage potential in millions of others. So not just a few people, but millions. So I'm selective about what speaking events I go to, because what I'm looking for is an amplifier effect. So it either must be a big event with hundreds of people there, or even if it's a smaller event, if they've got an ability to amplify that message, then that's more important to me, because that actually achieves my kind of vision at a bigger level much more easily. Equally, from a values point of view, if somebody asks me to go and do something, and I can use my values and my principles to have a quick sense check against everything. So practically now, if I'm asked to do something, the first thing I'll always be doing is getting out my VMVP and just sort of going, does this fit? And it stops distraction, Ben.
Okay.
One thing that people, I'm sure, can identify with is, you know, feeling like they're being pulled from pillar to post. You know, they're busy, they're very activity orientated. Whereas I've become much more output and impact orientated about how I spend my time. And the only way I've been able to really, I guess, achieve that is by having my vision, mission, values, and principles clear at all time.
Yeah.
I can be personally open to audit. So, you know, do I live my values? Do I live my principles? You know, if you are asked to be put into a compromising position by somebody, you know, it could be even by a friend who, you know, asks you to lie for them, for example, to get them out of a sticky situation. In my values, that just can't now hold true.
Yeah. So I think I heard you talking about physically checking and reviewing your VMVP. So is that to say, like, do you have that printed off somewhere? Is it written? Do you keep it in a notepad? And are you kind of physically kind of looking at it a couple of times a week? Like, what is that? Because people listening will want to be like, this is great, Ben. This is great, Phil. But like, tell me, what do I do? Like, what's the action? How do I make this stuff work?
Yeah, so the first thing is that you've got to have specificity first about what they are. And this is the most difficult bit, is the crafting on a word by word basis to get these values and principles correct.
Right.
That firstly can take many months to marinate. So you can sketch it out firstly, you know, what does this mean? Well, for example, so let me give you an example from my own. So one of my values is truth and honesty. That's a paired value. And underneath that, there are three things, which is be truthful to self, be truthful to others and tell my truth to others, and live my truth. So that's what truth and honesty means in my life.
Yeah.
So where does that exist? It's in Evernote and it's synced across every device that I own.
Okay, cool.
Whether it's on my phone, my laptop, my home computer, my iPad, it's always omnipresent digitally in my life, in order that I can always refer to it. So it's not in a drawer. Yes, it's on a piece of paper somewhere. Yes, it's in a, you know, a Moleskin book somewhere, but you've got to be able to practically look at these all the time. And even when you're being asked to create, you know, decisions on the fly, it's always available to me. And I think that's part of the trick of using technology to also assist you in this process.
Yeah. So for you, so it often is the case that you'll literally call that up on whatever device on Evernote, and you'll literally be looking at it, checking in on it as you're wrestling with big decisions.
Without a doubt. And I think the other thing is that my advice to people is to say, you know, this is an organic thing, and sometimes an experience or, you know, can present itself to you, and you check back against your values and go, do you know what? I'm going to change a word in my values, because based upon that last situation, I've got tested with something, and actually I've just realized I'm missing a word. Now, what is that word? And so, you know, I'll go out riding on a Saturday and just spend 3 hours on my bike thinking about that word. What is it that describes this? And this comes, I want to loop it back to this, the specificity of these words is really, really important. So, you know, if it's family first, for example, is one of your, you know, one of your values, that, you know, ask people why they do most things. It's actually, well, I'm doing it for my family. Okay, well, all right, with specificity, who is your family? Mm. Is it your direct wife and children? Wife, children, and mum? Does it exclude your brother? Include your brother? Because not every family relationship is, you know, is loving. It's not Little House on the Prairie, is it? In, you know, relationships are very dynamic. So in this thing, the specificity really informs everything. And when you can craft your words to get to a point where you go, do you know what? If that got etched on my gravestone in the future, I would be pretty happy that I've lived that life. Then I think you're 90% of the way there. But never, ever think it's the finished article. Broadly speaking, it should be, but always be coming back to it, checking back to it, and playing with those words based upon the experiences that present themselves to you.
I love that, especially your piece around specificity when it comes to values. I think it's super, super valuable. Like, as you were talking, I was reflecting on mine. So one of my paired values, to use your terminology, is family and balance. And I did the same. I like to hope and think I'm a good son to both of my parents. I've got an older sister. But specifically when I'm talking about family and balance, it's my wife Jo and my daughter Freya who I'm really, really talking about. And I think, again, this links to your stuff about doing some of that deep inner work, turning yourself inside out. I think, and I certainly wrestled with it at first. I'm saying, well, am I saying kind of my mum, dad, sister is less important than my wife and daughter? And you almost don't want to admit that because it seems wrong or morally wrong. But actually, that is the truth of it. Like, and it is what does family actually mean? I mean, that specificity is so powerful.
It's massive. And, you know, let's present an example where, you know, it's real for people, is that quite often I've been there myself. You're busy building a career, you know, it's all about the financials. You're trying to get a bigger house, you're trying to get bigger, and you say, why are you trying to do that? And you go, oh, because I'm doing it for my family. Mm. Often when you're challenged with, well, okay, so you realize there's a cost to all this, which is actually you're not spending time with your family. You're working all the hours God sends to do this, but you're not seeing your kids grow up. Your kids feel emotionally detached. You know, your marriage could be under crisis. And actually go, is that the consequence that you want, that you're driving so hard for? Well, now that's the opposite of what I want. It's like, well, okay. Let's loop back again.
Yeah.
And well, actually, maybe right now, family first could be spending more time in a present way in the family household than it is going to one extra networking event because you think it's going to give you the breakthrough, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess the real moments where these values can come into play.
Yeah, it's amazing. Phil, I want to be respectful of your time. I know you're a very busy man trying to lead a business in the height of the COVID-19 crisis, 1 week into lockdown in the UK. So I've got a couple of slightly more sort of rapid fire questions for you. I'd love to ask you. What do you do to sort of manage your energy to recover, regenerate? What does that look like for you?
Energy management, Ben, is, I think, one of the big tricks for any leader fundamentally is knowing how you replenish your energy and how you deploy your energy, I think, is one of the really key things. So energy calibration and regeneration is a theme I think any leader should have at the top of their head. You know, put your own oxygen mask on before you help others. You know, we've all heard that. But, yeah. But at this particular point in time in this crisis, you have got to make sure you've got your own oxygen mask on. So for me, I'm a keen cyclist and I spend 8 to 10 hours a week on my bike. And on my bike, I do some of my best thinking. I defragment as an individual and being outside, because I'm slightly more extroverted as a character. You know, I enjoy just being out, having the sun on my face. And that really is my plug-in moment.
Right.
I preserve and diarize time. And this is one of the key things that I think that when people get into a leadership role, you know, be kind to yourself. Make time for you to make sure your energy levels are going to be right, because you never know where you're going to need to apply that energy. Yeah. And sometimes you've got to dial it up to 10, and other times you can really ratchet it back to a 1. And that's about having situational awareness of a leader of any situation that you're in, either individually or business-wise, and making sure that then you've got the energy resources to deal with it.
Great, amazing. And what are you reading or learning about, studying right now? Kind of what are you doing there? I know you're a big kind of lifelong learner.
Yeah, I mean, you know, despite listening to loads of podcasts, which is my sort of preferred medium going to work and back any day, I've just dived back into a Jim Collins book, actually, which is Great by Choice. I've always been a big fan of Jim Collins' work. It's quite empirical, you know, Great by Choice, I think, has got some really, really fantastic insights in it for where we are right now. You know, we're in this kind of unknown territory. We're needing to make rapid decisions. But what we must do is, you know, be very disciplined about the things that you do. So he brings out such, you know, things as 20-mile march, which is, you know, really having a discipline to, you know, do the same thing. If really be thinking about the short burst journeys, stop, re-energize, get out, get it done again. You know, which I think at this particular time, businesses need a lot of discipline. You know, the SMAC recipe, be specific, measurable, and consistent about the things that you're asking people to do. Provide clarity, fire bullets, not cannonballs. Don't bet everything on, you know, on one big idea right now to save you. Test, quickly learn, find out what works, then go from there. So I'm really enjoying just sort of jumping into that book. And I'm also reading The Infinite Game, Simon Sinek, which appeals to me, you know, very much in the way that I think about really thinking in much greater terms of your leadership footprint beyond even just the economic objectives of your own business, but thinking of really, you know, of everything in an infinite game, which I quite like that book. I've liked some of the stuff he's written in the past. So I'm just diving into that and just seeing what that tells me.
Great. And final one, are there any particularly impactful, interesting, unusual sort of routines or rituals that you have that help you play as your best as an individual and leader that you can share with us?
Yeah, I think that one thing that I do at work, which sometimes people find a bit curious, is that, of course, being a computer printer brand, I'm bound to say this, aren't I? But actually, I horizon plan my diary 3 to 6 months out all the time, Ben. And so what I do is I actually print my Outlook diary out. I then lay it out in a horizon timeline on a desk.
Right.
And what I then do is zoom out for the next 6 months and look at when my peaks and troughs are. So we already always know that we've got some seasonal demands on us. So, you know, I've got a big seasonal demand right now. I've got financial year end. We've got financial year kickoff. We've got to get all the stat accounts done. So I can look at that period very quickly on a zoomed out basis relative to the things that are coming in the future. Equally, you know, if quite often I find with people that they're sort of looking from week to week in their diaries and, you know, they begin to lose track of the horizon.
Yeah.
Do a meet next week. Oh, yeah, I can do a meet. You fit a meet in. But if you've lost track that there's something really big on your horizon that actually is more deserving of that time right now, then you've got to make sure that you then put a big box in which says, I'm doing nothing, no meetings. Or if you think there's a lot of load there in that particular period, I've got a lot of travel, you know, I'm out the country for 3 days and I'm back and I'm on meetings for a day. That Friday in 3 weeks' time, I'm going to be working from home. Mm. So I can horizon it. I'm going to be working from home then. Why? Because I know I'm going to be tired. I'm going to need to catch up some things. I need no interruptions. And I kind of just need to be able to, you know, get up and get to my desk and get going without having an hour to work and an hour back. So a big trick that I've found works ever so well for me when you're running a large and complex organization is to always be horizon scanning your diary for the future. And then you can make better decisions in the present.
I love that. If I'm sitting here with a huge grin on my face, which you can see because we're doing this via a video Zoom call. Like those that have followed me for a while or have worked with me would probably think that was a completely engineered and set up question, because one of the things I talk about so much is mapping out your year and 90-day plans and printing your calendar for the next 2 weeks and looking 2 weeks out so you can say to yourself, what do I need to be doing this week so I'm on the front foot in 2 weeks' time rather than reacting. So I absolutely love that. I think we're kindred spirits in terms of that way of working.
Can I offer one more then, Ben?
Yeah, far away, please do.
I just want to zoom that out much bigger then. I also have a similar zoom out looking at the next 20 and 30 years. And so everyone can do this. It's really simple. Now, if you've got time at home now, you can do it. Take a piece of paper, draw a circle in the middle of that piece of paper, then draw a circle outside of that and another one outside of that and another one outside of that. And then what you do is put lines through it like you're slicing up a cake. Add a theme to each of those areas. So it could be financial, life, family, you know, career, whatever that might be. And then each of those circles can represent the next 5 years for you. So then by each theme, just have a think about writing in some of the things that you want. And actually, another important slice of that is key dates. And so as a parent, Ben, you know, if your daughter's eight, then look at key dates. Look at when she's going to be 18, 21. Think about when you're going to be 40, 50 and 60. When your marriage might be 5 years anniversary, 10 years. Look at all of those key dates on your future. Then look at all of the elements that you want to achieve in your life on that more zoomed out basis. And this is what I then describe becomes your dot on the horizon, your direction of travel.
Yeah.
And it's surprising when you've got a general view of your life on a zoomed out basis and you think, oh, okay, oh, that's really good. So even simple work like that can make me realize that actually my son and I, he's going to be 30 in the same year as I'm going to be 60. And our birthdays are 2 weeks apart. So I'm already looking forward to that date in my future to say, we're going to have one hell of a party at that time. So zooming out in that way also gives you a lot of clarity about decision-making. Is this going to help me on this broad direction of travel if I say yes to this now or not? particularly if it's committing your resources, financial or time. When suddenly you've got clarity on the things you've got to get done in the bigger picture in the next 5, 10, 15 years. And don't take it so literally, that's the point. You know, this is not a plan for you to feel let down by if you don't achieve it. This is your broad direction of travel. So once you combine those two things, it becomes a very powerful intent for you as an individual about how you should spend your time and effort.
That's amazing. I want to say thanks for sharing that. And actually, the first time kind of we met, I don't know if you remember, was I think it's about 3.5, 4 years ago when you spoke at a Benchmark for Business conference. And I heard you talk about that then. And ever since, I do that exercise every year. It's so powerful. So like, thank you personally for that. And like, I'm sure it'd be super valuable for the people listening as an exercise.
Terrific.
Brilliant. Phil, I'd say I want to be really respectful of your time. So thank you for your time, especially right now. As I said, you're MD, manager of business in the midst of kind of COVID-19. You mentioned it's coming up to year end for you. So really appreciative of you making the time. We could have talked for another hour. I'm sure people are gonna love it. So maybe at some stage in the distant future, we'll have to get you back on for part two if you're up for that.
Pleasure, no problem at all. And if people want to ask me any more about this, you can find me on Twitter at PhilJones40.
I was just gonna ask how people can find out more. So there we go, at PhilJones40. Brilliant. Thanks very much, Phil. Thanks for your time. Stay safe.
So there you have it, folks, my interview with Phil Jones from Brother UK. I really hope you enjoyed that episode, but most importantly, I hope you learned loads from it. I mean, I know I certainly did. If it was helpful, it would be amazing if you could share the link to the episode on your social media channels, as it really does help us get the message out there and grow the audience for the podcast. And I've also got a very special bonus for you. I've been working with a fantastically talented artist over in Italy to create a visual summary of each episode, which really captures the most salient points from that particular episode. If you'd like to grab those for the first 5 episodes, simply type www.ben-morton/podcast into the address bar on a web browser, and it will take you straight to a page where you can sign up and get those podcasts. Do make sure you type it directly into the browser rather than a Google search on it, otherwise it might not take you to the right page. That's it for this episode. See you in another one. Take care and lead on, folks.